part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm gonna do it part. I'm gonna do it part-time. I'm gonna do it part. Fanboy.com.
All right, should we just get started?
Yeah, let's do it. Introduce yourself.
This is Christian Horn.
And this is Paul Edwards.
Yes, and we are of Part-Time Fanboy. Dun, dun, dun. And it's been a pretty crazy week. I mean, do you think we should say something about Leonard Nimoy before we get started?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think we should?
I mean, I don't know. I was pretty blown away when I found out the news.
I found out from you. You were the first person that I knew who, you know, had known about it, you know, sort of posted the information. And it was just, I felt sad because, you know, it was something I knew was coming. It seemed, you know, the signs were there, but, you know, still bummed me out, you know?
Yeah.
He's just an amazing person.
Yeah.
You know? I think one of the things that people are finding out now is, you know, beyond just the Spock thing, is just like sort of what an amazing artist and, you know, writer and photographer he was. And
yeah.
I'm hoping if nothing else that we're going to see, you know, sort of a revival of certainly of his photographic work, which is pretty stunning.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I've heard. I haven't had a chance to look at it myself. I mean, you know, for me, it's like when I found out, it was like really weird. I kind of took it like really hard. I was at work and mm-hmm. it kind of came up on my computer and I almost had to like get up and like get away from my desk and like go to the men's room or something. Cause he was such a huge, like, I don't even know. He was such a huge part of like my growing up, like mm-hmm. my childhood. Like I watched Star Trek like religiously, like, because it was always on, particularly in high school, it was on like late at night, like at 11 p.m. or something, and then right. on Saturdays it would be on in the afternoon. And I was a big, you know, Trekker, not like a fanatic, but I just loved that original show. And it was just really weird how hard it hit me. Like I was just like, I can't, like, God knows how I'm going to react when Shatner goes, because
it's hard too, because I mean, we're pretty much, you know, we're almost like sort of at 50% of the cast left.
Yeah, I know.
And it's heartbreaking. Time moves on, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, he was just by all accounts, such a wonderful person. And you know, again, he genuinely, you know, cared about his art, and that I think that came across in everything they did. And you know, he directed two of the best of the Star Trek movies. So,
yep.
You know, we're he definitely leaves a good legacy behind.
Yeah, yeah, and also directed Three Men and a Baby, right? Which was like a
huge hit. That's right,
huge hit. Which to me is like, I always wondered like why he never just went full on into directing. It seems like he got his Jones and,
he was good at it. You know, it provided him with enough opportunities to do, you know, what he wanted. And, but that was the impression I always got out of him, is that, you know, he had so many more interests than, you know, just acting, you know, directing or anything. You know, he just really wanted to do, you know, pretty much everything. You know, it seemed like he dipped his toe
well-rounded
into every water. And, you know, he's a real, really neat dude.
Yeah, he also seems like, I mean, I think there might have been a period, but he also seems like, you know, because obviously he wrote a book, I Am Not Spock, you mm-hmm. know, but he seems to have been one of the ones that never really got weighed down by, you know, sort of the albatross that Spock could have become or became, mm-hmm. like during, a certain period of his career, you know. I just remember him, you know, big time from In Search Of, too, you know, that mm-hmm. show. And just what a great voice he had and how he could just, like, you know, he had a really good way of, like, evoking the mystery of everything on that show. That was another big memory. So it's just, like, really weird because unlike, like, say, somebody like Christopher Reeve, you know, who was, like, a big, big deal when he passed away for me mm-hmm. because of the Superman movie, you know, I didn't expect to take it as hard as I did, but I it's just like, wow. Talk about a guy who just looms large.
And not only that, but, I mean, he, I think, touched – like so many people with Spock.
Yeah.
You know, because like that's sort of, I was just judging by my Facebook friends, you know, like I know a great number of people, you know, of all sort of walks of life,
you know,
and different places. And man, that was like something that everybody, you know, was genuinely sad about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's something that connected with everyone. And Spock is such a great, you know, sort of outsider figure, you know.
Because
he's literally, you know, the dude who's sort of torn between two worlds.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like, you know, people empathized with him, and he realized, you know, later he did do his other book called I Am Spock.
Yeah.
And it's you know, he sort of embraced, instead of like fighting against it, he really embraced what it brought to people. And
yeah,
you know, I think that resonates with a lot of people. And it, and you know, he, like I said, you know, he cared about his work, he cared about people, and that just came across in everything he did.
Yeah, by all accounts. I mean, the George Takei posts were just like, wow. Like, you know, he was just saying, like, this was a good man, he was a good friend to me, and all that stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, a constant. Even Shatner, who, you know, can be a little abrasive, or, you know, apparently the news broke today that he didn't attend the funeral because he had a commitment to a charity or something like that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, but, and you can't really blame the guy for that, you know.
Yeah.
If anything, I think Nimoy would have been out there like, yeah, you know, by all means, you know, you do your things for the charity.
You know,
because that's going to, and, you know, plus, you know, he's 83. He can't, like, just sort of hop on a plane and, you know.
Yeah.
Do what he used to do, you know.
That, to me, is, like, the biggest deal, like, that he was 83, and I think Shatner's going on, like, 85 or something.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, these people, you know, I mean, they're still active, they're still dynamic. It's like Stan Lee being, like, 90, mm-hmm. whatever, one or two. It's like these people are still dynamic, they're still out there doing it, they're still, you know, being, you know, they're still gregarious, like, involved in everything. And then when they just pass away, it almost feels like, oh, he was like 30 or something. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't feel like he should have been 83. But, you know, so in a way, I guess he achieved his immortality, you know.
I agree.
And hopefully, you know, Spock, you know, and his other works, you know, will just continue out through the ages. But, you know, I just figured we should take at least a couple of minutes to acknowledge, like, what an impact he's had on, you know, on us, you know, just as nerds and stuff like that, you know.
I think that, you know, I mean, I remember, I think Wrath of Khan was the first movie that, like, just tore me up inside.
Not even kidding.
And, you know, that's, I mean, I still can't even look at, you know, some of the, you know, like the images of that. And it still gets to me because, because it was so hard, because it was, like, so earned too, because you know, you'd seen him on TV, you know, you had this long relationship with him, and then you know, when he died, I mean, it was sort of the first moment that, like, you know, I mean, I had known people who had died, you know, but this was more real to me in a way.
Oh no, like, for me, what that did was, you know, I've spoken,
I'm sure it had to, like, really hit you.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, my father died when I was 5, and I can't remember when Wrath of Khan, what year it came out, but I think it was pretty young, like, when mm-hmm. it came out. And for me, it was like a real like hammer. Like yeah. I just remember being in the theater. Like, you know, I've talked on this podcast as before about how much the first Superman movie and that heart attack scene, you know, affected me. But Spock was the other big childhood memory. When he dies in that second movie, like I think, like I was in Michigan. It was summertime. I was visiting my aunt, and I think my cousin may have taken me. I can't remember, but it's a big movie memory because when he dies, I was a mess. I just remember being sobbing in the seat, like in the theater, and I'm sure people were like, "Get it together, kid." But it was a really cathartic moment because it let me, you know, that's what movies do for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It let me have that release of like, you know, obviously I'm feeling bad for Spock and it's like, no, Spock is really dead or whatever, you know, but when it just let me have one of the first releases I can remember as a kid for the death of my father. Mm-hmm. So like it was rough. And it's a beautiful scene. People have been posting it all over and I've been resisting it because I've been resisting watching it because I actually want to sit down and watch that movie, you know, from beginning to end. And it's just been a busy weekend. But
I came across a really interesting thing because, you know, what his other sort of big movie role, you know, his sort of non Spock big movie role was in Invasion of the Body.
Yeah. Actors. Oh, he's great in that.
And he is fantastic. The bagpipe version of Amazing Grace that plays at the end of Invasion of the Body Snatchers is the same one that plays in the
really
in Wrath of Khan. Yeah.
Oh my God! Wow. It's
just sort of a weird little synchronicity thing.
Holy cow! Well, this definitely makes me want to read Nicholas Meyer's like a View from the Bridge, that book, right? I've always wanted to read that book, and I'm definitely going to have to pick it up now. But anyway, so we should just say that, you know, thank you to Leonard Nimoy. Thank you, Mr. Spock. Thank you for, you know, everything that you contributed. I don't know if you can hear us, but, you know, it's a far, far better place that you go to, right? You know?
And he made this place a far, far better place.
It's true. It's true. It's true. Okay. Well, thanks. Yeah. And damn. See, I'm getting choked up just even thinking about it. All right, let's move on to something less dignified. What we're really here to talk about.
Far less dignified, but yeah.
Far less dignified. So, what did we watch? Generation X, the TV movie pilot.
It's not just a Douglas Coupland novel anymore. It's
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's go back a little bit because several months ago we reviewed the Doctor Strange TV pilot that was on YouTube, and we had a lot of fun with that. And so I figured it was time to break out another old, you know, superhero movie that hadn't been seen in a long time, or pilot, or something.
Dude, we should just do a series of sort of failed comic book pilots.
Oh, we're gonna do it.
I mean,
There's
so many.
And YouTube has made it possible. The internet has made it possible. No. This is by far not the last one that we're gonna do. I can't wait. Or whatever, just like cheesy superhero movies. But yeah, I figured it was time to dust something off. And for some reason, the Generation X pilot popped into my head, and I was like, "You guys want to do this?" And you were like, "Oh yes, oh yes."
Well, dude, I watched it when it aired.
Me too.
That was my.
But I shut it off. I think.
You know, here's the thing, and let's back up a little bit too. I mean, I haven't been on the podcast for a little while, but one of the nice thing that you know, being off for a while, as I've been able to listen to you guys as sort of like a fan this time. Uh-huh. And you know, one of the episodes I really liked was where you and Ian were talking about the whole Image comics and you know, sort of, you know, how that changed comics. And I think in a way Generation X sort of grew out of that whole little thing, you know, because, you know, for a while there, you know, you had your X-Men universe, you know, that was sort of, you know, taken to new heights by Jim Lee.
Yeah.
And at least in terms of popularity. And then suddenly there was like just an explosion of X books, man.
You had
X-Force, X-Man, you know?
Yeah.
And then Generation X,
yes.
Which was the superhero team they spun off of the X-Men back in 94, right?
Well, yeah, according to Wikipedia, it was 1994, September. That's right. 1994. And this is probably... Yeah, I mean, this is a couple years after, like, all the Image creators left. And,
right.
Did you read the book when it came out? Like, did you pick it up? Like,
no, I didn't.
Oh, I totally did. I was still hard. I don't know if I was hardcore into the X-Men. Yeah. I think this is when the universe started to expand way too much beyond my grasp.
Yeah, I remember that was when it was really exploding. And I think at that time, I was just having to sort of cut back on... you know, the number of books I was reading.
Yeah.
And I sort of, at that point, was just, okay, you know what? Anything that's got an X in it, I just can't do it because everything crossed over. This was, I mean, as it was, this grew out of like a crossover event.
The Phalanx.
As it was. And so I was just like, you know, I can't afford to keep up with it. Even though I sort of liked the basic premise of the group, which was, you know, sort of along the lines of New Mutants.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a new team being raised up. And I like the fact that they were being raised, you know, not by Charles Xavier, but by, you know,
Emma
sort
Frost.
Of Xavier's proteges and by Emma Frost. You know, this was when Emma Frost had just sort of turned to the light side.
Yeah.
You know, after years of being their sort of, basically, she's sort of the anti-Xavier, you know?
Well, she was following sort of in the, yeah, the anti-Xavier is a good way to describe her, but she was sort of following in the footsteps of Magneto, right? Like,
right,
Magneto
right.
had reformed, and Emma Frost in the X-Universe had... They were running a separate school, like
right.
in the New Mutants. They were running a group called the Hellions, right?
The Hellions, right.
Yeah,
she was in charge of the Hellions, and like that was sort of like the evil version of the New Mutants.
The New Mutants, yeah.
And they, had, and like, they basically costumes. Ended up getting slaughtered.
Yeah, they got slaughtered. I'm not sure I think it was in the Mutant Massacre, where
right.
they just got like, the whole team just got killed, and it was just, it was one of those events that Marvel like enacted, like I think in the like late 80s or early 90s where they were trying to sort of thin out the herd. Cause I think again, this was a situation where they were like, there's too many mutants, you know? And
they gotta get rid of some of them. They sort of like, would, I don't know, it's weird. It's like gardening, you know, like they would have burst of like all these mutants that they created, and then they would go have some big event to wipe them all out.
Exactly.
You know, it's but Emma Frost did sort of turn after that event, you know.
It
caused her to realize that, you know, she had a responsibility to the kids that she was bringing up, and you know, she sort of reforms and ends up being sort of the leader of this team with Banshee, was, you know, one of the X-Men there from back from X-Men 94, right? Isn't that when he joined up?
Yeah, well, wasn't he? I'm not exactly sure, but he joined up like right after or right around where it was like the all new X-Men.
Yeah. I think he was in like 94, but he wasn't in like
he shows up for a long time. Oh no, actually, he shows up in X-Men number 28.
Oh, wow.
So he showed up like way back in the 60s, and then I think they brought him back.
Yeah.
I think he was one of those mutants that kind of like made an appearance, and maybe they didn't know what to do with him, but he was like involved in Interpol, and he's Irish, you know, and I always thought he was Scottish, but I guess he's Irish.
He's Irish, you know,
Sean
because
Cassidy.
You know, Banshee, you know,
That's right, duh. That's right.
You know, to give them a credit, you know, it was sort of like comics' first attempt at going, you know, international, you know,
even though
you know he's a drunken Irishman. It was kind of cool in the fact that, like, you know, you've got a group of, you know, sort of young mutants, and of course, you know, because they're Generation X, you know, they're edgy. Like all, you know, sullen, bitter little, you know, bastards who are growing up in a world that doesn't understand them.
Yep.
Like, all members of our generation. Well,
I just remember that Generation X, like I remember that was one of the X books at the time that I was very excited about. And it was because it was being illustrated by Chris Bocciolo. Chris Bocciolo had done a book for Vertigo, or I don't know if it was even being called Vertigo at that point, called Shade the Changing Man.
Oh my God.
But his work on that book just blew my mind. It just like opened up the doors. I had never seen anything like it.
Yeah.
His page construction. And I just loved it. And
he did the Two Death miniseries. I really remember him from.
He
sort of, in a way, did sort of the iconic version of Gaiman's death character.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? You're absolutely 100% right. And I think that this was sort of Bocciolo. Like, obviously, he had worked on Vertigo, but I think this was like Bocciolo's first, like, sort of like breaking through to the big time, where it was like, ooh, it's like a high visibility X book. And, you know, these things were selling. They were selling like hotcakes.
Yep.
And, you know, if anything, like 1994 is that at the time of like just the giant speculation boom is like in full effect. And you can tell because if you search for Generation X issue one, you see that it's like the cover is like a full like wide panel, you know, spread front and back, and it's like one of those chromium metallic covers. So it was like sort of a big deal. This wasn't like something that was like a small release. This was like, you know, this was going to be, I don't know exactly what, but it was hyped at the time, and it was going to be like very different and very strange. And you could tell from the characters. I mean, they had one guy, his name was Chamber. Half his face was blown off because the first time he ever used his power, he blew off the bottom half of his face, you know?
And he's so, a very interesting looking character.
Yeah.
With like the sort of, I don't know, if Firestar had like the bottom half of his face on fire, you know, and he didn't wear like the brightly colored, you know, poofy outfit.
You mean Sunfire or?
No, I was thinking of Firestorm. You know?
Firestorm. Okay. Exactly. If it was the other way around, instead of the flaming head, he had a flaming mouth. No, I mean, and a lot of the characters' powers were really different too, because you had a character, her name was called Husk. I very distinctly remember this, where what she would do is she would rip her skin off. And underneath it would be like diamond or stone or something like that.
She was related to one of the New Mutants, right?
I think so. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I think she was like, she was Cannonball's sister. That's what it was.
Oh, was she?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, then you had, you know, the dude with the skin, you know, the skin.
His name was just Skin.
Oh, yeah, who had, like, all this extra skin, who could, like, stretch, and he had this, like, sort of really, like, this gray, sort of pallid face, you know, kind of droopy skin and everything, and he looked super cartoony. And, you know, it was a pretty interesting sort of group, and unfortunately, I just, you know, I did go pick up a few of the issues and look around through. I just don't think that the writing ever quite, did the group justice.
Well, it was Scott Lobdell who wrote the initial issues, right? Mm-hmm. And I think he was one of the guys that picked up the X-Men when Chris Claremont left or was booted off, you know, depending on who you talk to, you know. But and I just remember really not being too keen on him during the X-Men books. I don't know if you can say it was his fault, but there was just so much crazy stuff with that universe, you know what I mean?
And
it's just so hard to wrangle. So I don't know that the subpar writing can be blamed on I think it's Lobdell. But you know, it definitely was a book that I started reading and then dropped very quickly after, because I think this was sort of they were trying to balance like the craziness of the X-Men, but they were the like how crazy the X-Men had become, mm-hmm. And trying to ground it in some of in a little bit of reality, and it just wasn't working. And I think that that's something that Grant Morrison tried with his run too.
Yeah,
like introducing these weird mutants that were like really weird. You know what I mean?
And interestingly enough, too, like the and the book went on for quite a while, too.
Yeah.
Warren Ellis tried to revamp it along with a bunch of the other ones. They did that. They called it like Counter-X or something like that.
Yeah.
Where Warren Ellis was doing it. I thought overall, I guess they did a pretty good job with it. But then when Grant Morrison sort of came in and wanted to do X-Men, he wanted to take, you know, a few of the characters from other books and... it's in a way, it's like when Morrison came on board, they just sort of like wiped the slate clean, and they used elements from some of the books to make the new team.
Yeah.
Emma Frost being the one that, like, I think, you know, he really wanted over back on X-Men book.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think part of the reason that it got canceled too was, again, it suffered under the whole, there's too many mutants. Like the one account that I read online was that Quesada, you know, was like, dude, we got too many mutant books.
Yeah.
And that was one of the smartest things he ever did, you know.
Dude, he canceled 6 X books.
That's crazy, which he was smart to do, because, like, I think that when Quesada now there's all these crazy books, but when Quesada originally came on and started sort of like writing the ship, you know, that was one of the best things he ever did, was just like, we got to trim the fat, you know, we got to get rid of, because, you know, that was sort of the thing, is like, if you were reading Avengers or Spider-Man, the X books were like existing in their own universe, and it was like, wait a minute, and almost threatening to just take over the whole line, right?
At one point. Pretty much. I mean, I think it became to the point where there were more like mutants than there were actual human beings.
Right? Or regular just plain superheroes. All right. But, so at some point,
Some point, New World Entertainment and Fox decided that, you know, hey, this would make an interesting, you know, way to spin this off into a TV series.
Yeah,
you know, this will be a good entry into the X universe for, you know, for moving picture media.
Yeah.
This is sort of the first X-Men movie.
It really kind of is. Like, that's the interesting thing. I mean, did you notice, I looked up, you know, first of all, like, well, we can get into the plot a little bit, but did you know that the location, the mansion for this is the same?
It's the same as in the X-Men movies.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
So, I mean, it's, you know, and of course, you know, well, that's also, you know, the Smallville house for Lex Luthor. You know,
I didn't know that.
It gets used a lot for, it's sort of the generic rich person's home.
Up in Canada.
Vancouver. That they're allowed to shoot in. Yeah. But really it was, I mean, it's the first one of the X-Men. Yeah, these are the first X-Men characters ever in
live action.
Like live action.
It's the first attempt, I think. Movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, so you have to sort of, and also the fact that, you know, it's crazy because it's a made for TV film.
I mean,
we should say that right away. It came out in February of 1996.
Yes.
Dude, that's only 3 years before the X-Men movie.
Yeah, like 3 or 4 years. Yep. Which is bizarre. It's like, you know, because this, I mean, I don't know your opinion, but this movie was like an abject failure. I mean, it's pretty rough. I mean,
let's put it this way. If you were going to like sort of think about like a cliche 90s movie.
Yeah.
This is it, man. Like, this is like sort of the worst stuff of the 90s, you know, or like the most, like, you know, commodified stuff of the 90s, like sort of in one package.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the color scheme of the thing, you look at you look at the costumes of the thing,
the writing,
you expect them to be like, wow, man, that's totally rad.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, to the extreme.
What's really interesting to me is how 80s the whole thing looked. There's a lot of like neon coloring. It's very network TV. Like, you know what I mean? But at the same time, it's very 90s. You know what
I mean? Oh, yeah. The 80s and the 90s sort of shared a
aesthetic.
So they shared a pop culture aesthetic that, you know, in when it's done well, you know, it's like, oh, wow, that's really good. And when it's done wrong, it like really comes off very silly.
Yeah. You know what? When I was watching this thing and I just looked it up, I just kept thinking, like, was Buffy the Vampire Slayer around at this time?
No.
Buffy didn't debut until the next year. But it seems like that this sort of thing, I mean, the way that it was made didn't have potential, you know, but you could have made something really good or interesting.
And, you know, here's sort of the crazy thing, too, is that the director of this movie, Jack Shoulder, directed one of my absolute favorite 80s movies.
Which
called
was?
The Hidden.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, The Hidden, you know, with what's his face?
Kyle MacLachlan
and Michael Nuri. Yeah, you know.
He did one of the worst Nightmare on Elm Streets.
Oh, he did the second one then.
Yeah, the second one. You got it.
Which actually, I mean, I think has its own little charms.
Oh, wait.
But yeah, I mean, you know, he's definitely a competent, you know.
Yeah, no,
dude.
He's...
It's just that
he directed By Dawn's Early Light. Have you ever seen that?
No, I haven't seen that.
Powers Booth, Rebecca De Mornay, and it's like a nuclear bomber attacks the Soviet Union, and they're like in a bomber, and they got to decide what they're going to do. It's a very good 90s movie. Wow, I'm impressed. So this guy's directed good stuff.
Yeah, he's a competent dude.
It's interesting because this movie is very. I got the feeling while I was watching the whole thing that it's filled with capitulation. Like there is no, there's not one voice directing, like guiding this ship. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it definitely does have the air of something where like executive decisions were being made in the middle of filming.
Yeah,
you know what
absolutely.
I mean? Like, you know, we'd love to do that, but we don't have the budget. So you're going to have to make up something else on the fly.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, it's very funny because like there's a lot of themes in here. There's a lot of stuff that happens that, you know, I mean, let's just talk about the basic plot a little bit, which is anybody who's ever read an X-Men book in the past 20 years, it's basically that there's a mutant registration act that's been pushed through, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's mutants developing powers, and the government in this reality is basically just arresting anyone who has superpowers without just cause. Like if you're suspected of being a mutant, they're basically taking you to camps, right? That's sort of like, which was the weird thing to me. Like I was like, whoa, this is like 1996, like Guantanamo. Like they're just basically like taking, you know, mutants and throwing them in work camps, you know?
The X-Men have always been ahead of their time.
Yeah. But I just found that to be a sort of a radical idea back in 1996. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the
you know, by this time, you know, in the comics, you had already gone through like the Days of Future Past stuff.
You already had,
you know, the God Loves Man Kills thing.
Yeah.
You know,
way before this. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So, you know, it's funny enough, by the time like it pops up here, like within the X books, this was sort of old hat.
Yeah, it was definitely old hat. But hindsight, you know, the way society is kind of now and things are developing and have developed, like to me, I was like, whoa, because there's a scene with Jubilee, you know, who is one of the mutants, and where she gets noticed in an arcade and the police just roll up on her and just like take her away. They don't read her rights. They don't do anything. So basically you're sort of dealing with like an almost fascist state where, you know, things have developed and there's no real explanation for it other than, you know, these guys are mutants. They've got powers. And, you know, I feel like they sort of missed the boat on the tone of the whole world. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that definitely the X movies really like nailed that a lot better.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, people were
definitely afraid of mutants.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a definite fear that sort of would lead up to something like that, you know,
yeah,
to an environment like that. But with this one, it just sort of jumped into that, you know, and so right away it's, you know, it's a little jarring. Totally,
yeah.
Tonally, this thing's sort of all over the map.
Big time, big time. And it seems like really that it wants to be something that it can't be.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like there's a bunch of moments where there's supposed to be violence or action or something hardcore is supposed to happen, and they just can't go far enough. Now, I don't know if that's because of network censors or they didn't have budgets or whatever, but
yeah,
like, I was very like,
well, I mean, let's talk about the team, you know, because
sure,
you know, they're sort of they made a few changes from the
comic
books.
Big time. Which they,
you know,
had
they,
to, yeah.
They had to, and then they didn't have to on some of it.
Yeah.
You know, you had Emma Frost from the comics.
Yes.
You know, okay, that's fine. You've got Banshee. Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
But the cool dude who we were talking about earlier, Chamber, you know, who's,
yeah,
you know, missing the lower part of his face and has this fiery stuff coming out. Yeah, they don't have the budget for that.
Yeah,
and again,
yeah,
this is also pre, you know,
CG yeah,
becoming really prevalent in every step of, you know, I mean, it was there, it had, you know, but it just wasn't cheap enough and it wasn't, you know, common enough to really work.
Yeah.
So they replace him with this dude called Refrax, who's like eyes, he has like X-ray vision and heat beam. So basically,
yeah,
they replace him with sort of like a Cyclops.
And they
knockoff.
Name him Kurt too. So he's sort of like this weird combination of Cyclops and like Nightcrawler.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
Like it's like they're winking at you, like, hey kids, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
and then meanwhile you're just like, this is so lame. Yeah.
Yeah. That was sort of a, I mean, so right away, like your most visually iconic character, gone.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
You
replaced
know, they,
with a stand-in, like a sort of subpar stand-in, because it's like, if you, especially if you're a fan of the books, you're like, I just want to see Cyclops, like,
yeah,
you know, of the X-Men. It's like, why are you sticking me with this sort of like half-assed, you know,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you're,
and then,
so then you're disappointed. Yeah, yeah.
And then Husk, you know, who rips off her skin to, you know, like reveal this new, you know, her new character, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't have the budget for that. So they get a girl who's like really strong.
Yeah, you get a girl who's like really strong, but her big thing, and you never really get to see the shape of her body, but you know, they explain in the show that, oh, her body is like massively deformed because she's super strong and, you know, her muscles are all out of shape. And then they show a scene of her like changing at one point, like
yeah,
in a changing room, and it's like a quick cut to like a female, the back of like a female bodybuilder,
right,
or something,
right.
And it's like, there's no way that body equates with that little girl that's, you know what I mean,
yeah,
in the giant,
yeah,
sweatpants. But you know, it's like, obviously, so you're absolutely right, there's like all these call outs to like, oh, there's no budget for this, you know,
yeah,
you know what I mean, yeah, yeah, so you're already kind of like disappointed from the outset. You
and then,
I mean?
And then, of course, they get to, this gets to be also the first time that like they get to whitewash an X-Men character too.
Yeah,
because Jubilee, who is probably like
one of the most
by this
popular,
time, like the most pop,
yep,
definitely the most popular character on this team.
Yeah, yeah,
for sure.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
you know, she was in the X-Men comics. You
well,
know,
she was like
she's
Wolverine
in the X-Men
sidekick
cartoon.
Yeah,
she's Wolverine
time
sidekick.
Yeah, yeah.
She's like the first, you know, Asian superhero to really be, you know, noticeable, you know, I mean, you know, you had Sunfire, but yeah, you know, he no one really,
yeah,
you know,
he never really
ever
hit
cared
it
about,
yeah,
Sunfire,
yeah,
but you know, but people like Jubilee, you know,
yeah,
they're like, yeah, she's awesome. And,
me too. Yeah, absolutely.
And then they cast this white girl.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Heather McComb, who apparently was, according to the Internet Movie Database, used to be married to Dawson from Dawson's Creek. What's his
James
name?
Vanderbeek?
James Vanderbeek. Yes, yes.
You mean
yeah,
you mean the dude who,
in the Power Rangers.
The dude in the from the Power Rangers yeah, exactly. thing this week. All right.
It's synergy. It's all happening, Paul.
It all wraps around.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, you basically got, you know, and they have Mondo, but in the book, Mondo is like heavy. Like heavy yeah. set, and they've got this guy, this actor Bumper Robinson, who worked a lot. You know, is actually, and according to the Internet Movie Database, again, mm-hmm. seems to be the go-to voice for the animated Falcon. Like if they need him in a TV nice. Show, they need him in a movie. He's the guy that does the Falcon, like on the Marvel animated stuff, or at least his credits seem to make it seem mm-hmm. that way. So yeah, you've basically got like. You've got the disappointment of like, oh, this is going to be really cheap because it looks really yeah. cheap. You know, not a lot of them use their powers at all for a chunk of it. And when they do, it looks kind of hokey or corny. I mean, I got to give them credit for attempting the skin stretching.
Yes,
you know? And there is even one scene towards the end where it's like, oh, look at that. You know what I mean? Like they mm-hmm. actually have him attack somebody by like trying to surround them. But that's the thing is like this whole thing is a mess.
I'll be honest with you too. Like with the effect, you know, the stuff that they do with Banshee, at least they tried to make it look like the comic book,
yeah,
you know, with the little Sonic thing.
Yeah,
and, you know, and what I felt really bad for is that, man, like all these actors pretty much were giving it their all here too, you know? Like, I mean,
the guy who plays Sean Banshee.
Yeah,
dude,
yeah.
That is straight out of a Lucky Charms
dude,
commercial.
Dude, he's a ham sandwich, man.
Oh, but, it's terrible.
But, I mean, at least, you know, like, there was nobody who was, like, sort of completely half-assing it. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, I felt like they were, you're right. I mean, I don't think that there was, I mean, okay. Like, if we're going to get into the action.
Yeah, let's get into it.
I mean... Okay, so let's talk about the general plot, because I took tons of notes, which are apparently not going to get used, but, you know.
That's fine. The general plot
the general
is, like,
plot,
you've got Max Headroom, who
Yeah,
is,
Matt Frewer, Russell
who
Tresh.
Is, basically experimenting on mutants.
Yes.
Right?
Well,
yeah.
In the very beginning, he's actually trying to cut a mutant open he's working for a corporation. He's trying to cut a mutant skull open so that he can get to the cells in the pineal gland, which apparently cause mutation. And he's interrupted by Emma Frost,
right?
Who, you know, and the guards run in and they grab him and they're like, "What are you doing?" And basically, no charges are being pressed against him because who cares about this mutant? And you know, Emma Frost gets angry and basically blows wind at them. Like, I wasn't sure what she was doing there.
I think that's supposed to be like her
telekinetic blast.
Telekinetic thing.
But it just came off as like blowing a
wind
breeze.
Machine.
Yeah. So anyway, the it picks up like 5 years later or something.
Right, right.
And the general thing of the plot is that Emma Frost and Banshee are assembling a team of kids, you know, because they know that mutants are being hounded and prosecuted, while at the same time, Russell Tresh, who is Matt Frewer's character, is trying to develop a machine that can go into people's dreams.
Into the dream dimension.
dimension, so that he can manipulate them for advertising purposes. At least that's the original reason that he
used.
But he's really looking for Emma Frost, who he's pissed off at for kind of ruining his career in science or something like that, right?
Yeah, and it's really sort of an odd, like, I mean, it's like the villain plot, like, doesn't match an X-Men thing.
No.
You know, it's like this really weird. Sort
I mean,
of generic...
it does, but it'll match like one of the plots that wasn't really great to begin with, and you kind of felt like you could skip those issues,
yeah.
Like with people battling on the astral plane or whatever. Like, but it's just a yeah.
It feels. I mean, and this is definitely this is one of those things where it feels like a movie made by a committee, you know,
yeah, in the sense big
of
time.
Like, you know, oh, we have this part of this script laying around from maybe, I don't know, like from our Doctor Strange thing, you know,
right?
Left over. Yeah. So we're going to have the astral plane here in the dream dimension, you know, but we're going to make it with mutants and, you know, and we're going to shoot everything with Dutch angles and light these, you know, those it's. Oh my God! All, you know those glass walls. You know the walls made up of like the little glass cubes.
Yeah.
Like they're in like every shot of this thing.
Yeah. I mean, look. I feel like the weakest thing in the whole thing were the scenes where and it just hurts me to trash an actor's work this badly. But Matt Frewer, like, I feel like he was committing to something that in a movie that he shouldn't have been in. Like this. The way that he played his character was it was so obvious that obviously this is 1996. Jim Carrey is at the height of his fame, you know, the big power, you know, everyone's crazy about Jim Carrey. And obviously Matt Frewer is a talented actor. I've seen him do really well in other stuff. You know, what's that show on BBC America that I'm blanking out on that I love so much? Well, he's on that. The clone thing. I'm blanking out. But
Orphan Black.
Orphan Black, yes, yes. But in this, it is nails on a chalkboard, dude.
He
is doing his best Jim Carrey impression.
In the wrong hands.
Oh.
In the wrong hands, he can chew scenery like nobody's
my
business.
My God. And then it's just like, so you've got Matt Frewer doing a bargain basement poor man's Jim Carrey, you know, where the director doesn't have the budget to manage the effects or properly direct the scenes that he's in. Because to me, it really seemed like, okay, set up the camera. Okay, Matt, just do what you're going to do. Like, do the dialogue and do your little shtick and whatever. But nobody was like, you know, I mean, even in a Jim Carrey movie, like, he's going to go, but you still have to edit correctly.
Yeah,
you still have to, you know, do things to make the performance coherent. Like,
and I get, and, you know, because I think a lot of his scenes are sort of independent of the, like, Generation X team.
Yeah.
You know, like, it almost feels like they shot a bunch of this stuff sort of separately and were just, and just sort of said, like, okay, we're doing a comic book movie, you know, so, you know, like,
It's obvious that the humor disease that infects so many bad comic book movie things got into this in a really bad way, because that's the thing, is like Matt Frewer just chews up scenery and he's trying to be funny and it's just not funny. So you've got that on top of the fact that what the villain really ends up being is just a poor man's Freddy Krueger. And they even reference Freddy Krueger in the beginning of the movie, which I forget exactly what movie or something we were talking about weeks ago. It's just like,
never reference something better than you are.
Yeah. And not even that, just because you reference it doesn't mean that it's okay to rip it off. You know what I mean? And so you've got those two elements about the villain that are just, they just don't work at all. And it just, not that the rest of it is like perfect or whatever, but the rest of it is enough of a sort of like 90210, you know, to use what was popular at the time terminology, knockoff, that maybe it could have worked in a weird way. You know what I mean? But it's just so all over the place, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, it's really interesting because it, even like, I think visually, like, it's kind of all over the place too, because like, you've got like sort of an attempt to match the comics with a few of the characters.
Yeah.
You know, like the actress who plays Emma Frost, you know, she somewhat looks like Emma Frost.
Well, let's just say right now that Finola Hughes is the best Emma Frost that we've seen, because what's her face from Mad Men, like, there was no Emma Frost in that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So Finola Hughes, I felt like, with the bad wig, and, you know, she's got a smoking bod, you know what I mean?
And she definitely has like sort of like that, you know, regal attitude, you know,
yeah,
that
the British
Emma
accent.
Frost needed. And the guy who plays Skin, you know, looks a lot like the comic book.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he sort of like, I mean, at least he has like the hair and sort of the generally sort of like.
Sure.
Dour feature and everything. Absolutely. Like that. And, you know, it's like it seems like they tried to match some things. And then in other ones, they were like, oh, you know, let's make the Jubilee a white girl. You know?
Or yeah, exactly.
You know, let's just make this guy. You know, so it's frustrating. Like, it's just sort of frustrating for, I think, as a. It's frustrating for a non-comic fan, and it's frustrating for a comic fan.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel like so much time was spent on the villain scenes that those should have been so minimal compared to the scenes of the kids getting to know each other. And the other thing, too, is that this really collapses into, again, the trap that a lot of them fell into, which is like so much time spent on getting the team together that mm-hmm. that it takes forever to get to the big fight or whatever at the end of the yeah. movie. And it's just like, oh my God, by the time you get to that big fight, it's so anticlimactic. And like the fight at the end where they finally face off against him, it was like 5 minutes long. I don't yeah. even think it was like 10 minutes long. And it's like, really? This is what I've been waiting for? You know, so much of it seems like filler. You yeah. know what I mean?
And interestingly enough, you know, it really makes me, you know, seeing this again really made me appreciate X-Men First Class so much.
Oh,
more.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's really, I mean, if you think about like sort of the young group there, it's very similar to this in terms of like, you know, they weren't mutants that you knew a lot about or anything.
Yeah.
And it did such a great job of like sort of throwing them together and like them having fun with their powers and like, but still, you know, getting on each other's nerves. And, you know, I mean, like overall, like, I mean, if nothing else, like watching this will make you appreciate all the work that has gone into the X movies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, like, yeah, let's see. It's really weird because there were also a lot of, I mean, there's references to Charles Xavier, like Xavier yeah. School, but he never shows up. You know, there's references to the Hellions. And, like, it's a one-off comment. And anybody who's watching this who's never seen, you know, there's all this stuff that you could have filled up backstory with, but you're spending so much time you know, filming Matt Frewer's like antics that it's just like, come on, you know, spend less time on that guy. They must have paid him a lot for this pilot because they just kept, you know, it just seemed like his scenes just, or maybe his scenes were just so intolerable to me that they just seemed like they were going on forever. But
no, he takes up, you know, that it's and it's another thing too where like, you know, where the villain. This is sort of a holdover, I think, in a way from like
Batman's
thing, is that like they get a little more enamored of their villains than they yeah. do their hero, you know. Yeah. And it's like, you know, I don't want to like spend a half of my movie watching the bad guy. I want, you know, I want my heroes.
Well, yeah, and that's what I feel like. I feel like he was a lot of filler. You know what I'm saying? I'm saying his antics and stuff like that. I feel like so many of his scenes went on at least twice as long than they needed to. You know what I mm-hmm. mean? Because he's doing, making faces and da-da-da, you know. And I'm just like, dude, you could have made like a sinister villain who's simple. Those scenes could have cut in half. And then you could have focused much more time on the kids, you know, the teachers, you know, yeah. like what is the, you know, explaining it more. And there's just stuff in here that's just like out and out weird. Like, you know, yeah. they go and they get Jubilee and they recruit her for the school. And then like one of the first things when she gets to the school is like, oh, you got to take all your clothes off and do a full body scan. And it's like, what? And Emma Frost is like standing there and Banshee is sitting at a computer and he's going to monitor it. And like, this is supposed to be like, ha ha, funny, but it's not.
It's just creepy.
It's yeah. like really creepy that you're recruiting these like teenagers and you're making them strip down in front of you. So, you know, you can do a test. Like, that's just freaking bizarre. And then there's just,
and the fact that everybody else has gone along with this. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
Like, oh, sure.
Yeah. yeah. Nobody's like, hell no. I'm not taking my clothes off. You know what I mean? I feel like, you know, there's just so much stuff, so many ridiculous, like, little things that are injected here that didn't need to be in there, where you could just focus on other things. And, you know, Bryan Singer, you know, that team, you know, as not super ultra crazy I am of the X-Men, you know, movies, especially like the first two or three or whatever, you know, you can see that, you know, having this as a primer and having seen this, you know, it really, like, I understand why I was sitting in the X-Men in the theater the first time I saw that Bryan Singer movie, and the beginning of it and like the first half of it. I remember turning to my fiance, now my wife, and being like, did they actually just make a good X-Men movie? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, being so impressed with it when it came out, because I was like, you know, and of course the first X-Men movie for me really peters out towards the end, where the plot almost becomes sort of like a typical crappy supervillain
plot, you know, with the whole Statue of Liberty thing.
It's just like where it just degrades, you know, and so I mean, it's just so funny. There's just so many things in here that like, and then, oh my God, like, I was just so blown away with some of the racist comments in here. Oh my God, he calls him like,
yeah.
What are the, one of the okay, so the kids go into town. He calls him, well, first of all, Matt Frewer calls Skin, like, in the final battle, like, an interdimensional wetback, which is like, what? And then there's a fight where Mondo, like, the kids go into town from the school and they get into it with some of the yuppie kids from you know, the local, the jocks. They get into a fight, and right as they're going to get into a fight, the jock says to Mondo, hey, Brillo pad head, or something like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? I was like, did he just say that? And there were also, I guess there's several different versions of this thing, but on the version that's up on YouTube, they left all the curse words in.
Yeah, must be the British cut what I was reading about that, because I don't remember that, you know, I mean, not that, like, I would have necessarily remembered something from, you know, that far away ago, but yeah, apparently in Britain, they prefer having, you know,
curse words,
more cursing and nudity in theirs.
Which works for me, but there's just a lot of like really silly stuff in here that seems completely unfocused. And
I remember when it aired, I was watching it with a couple of comic book fan friends of mine, and you know, like, after it was over, you know, they're like, what do you think, it's gonna get picked up? I was like, no, that's not good.
I don't think I even finished watching it. Like, I watched it, like, okay, so, like, yes, I mean, this is one of those things that I auditioned for in the 90s when I was acting, and I remember reading the script and knowing, like, the pages that I got, I was like, oh, okay, this is probably not going to be very good. But it was also at a time where nobody had expectations of superhero stuff being really good anymore. You know what I mean? Like, like, now the expectation is like, oh, it's going to be good, right? You know? But back then, you know, there's probably people out there who don't remember a time where it's like every superhero movie that came out was pretty much garbage, you know, with the rare exception, you know.
You know, you had a really dark period there between the late 80s and X-Men, really.
Yeah.
I think X-Men, you know, for all its faults, you know, that first X-Men did do a great deal toward turning it around, toward making it, a worthwhile story, you know, decent movie, and making it pretty fun again, because, you know, that first X-Men movie was pretty fun, thanks to Hugh Jackman.
Hugh Jackman, just like, say, can you imagine, like, I forget who the other actor was originally supposed to be cast in that role.
Doug Ray Scott.
I can't imagine whether, like, I don't know. I mean, I've seen Doug Ray Scott and stuff, but could he have pulled off Wolverine as well as Hugh Jackman did? I mean, I don't know. Like, it's just crazy. You know, because, I mean, let's face it, the first X-Men movie is basically Wolverine the movie. I mean, you know, I mean, there's other people in there, but you're mostly focusing on Wolverine for the first, like, half of it, right? So, basically, I don't know. it's like you want to say, like, I want to give them credit for, like, trying to do something, but it's just such a massive fail that I don't even know if I can recommend. Dude, I had to break this up into pieces.
Yeah,
to watch it. Like, it's really boring.
It's slow going.
And it's not even like a fun watch, like, this is so bad. Like, it's fun. Like, it's really like, yeah, I mean, there are scenes where it's like nails on a chalkboard. Like, you know what's funny is because, like, while I was watching it, the look of it reminded me of the, and sort of the pacing of it, although what I'm about to mention is better, the failed Doctor Who American Fox pilot.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very much that sort of thing, but Doctor Who, you know, while I don't think that thing is perfect by any means, at least had some focus of, like, vision, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering if they just had too many characters to stick in, like, a two-hour pilot to introduce.
That's part of it. And if, I think also the fact that it's kind of interesting that you brought up a Doctor Who thing, because I think in a way, like, there was a time where, like, that sort of was the default Fox movie pilot thing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they had, you know, they all, you know, they looked really slick, you know, but they were all super cartoony, you know, not a lot of, you know, attention paid to, like, an overall, I guess, you know, vision beyond the just sort of comic booky look of it, you know?
Yeah,
super really, like, ridiculously colorful, but also very kind of flat, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was an interesting time in the sense of, like, too, you know, this was sort of the only place we were getting,
yeah,
like, superhero and sci-fi stuff, you know?
Yeah.
It was, were these, like, sort of one-off, like, hey, this might be a series, but, you know, it's not gonna be.
Yeah. It's definitely one of those things where it's from a time where it's like, you could tell that certain people were trying their best, but, like, only a few, like, really nailed it out of the park, like something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And dude, honestly, that one didn't, like, get nailed right out of the park,
because
you had that movie, you know, that, like, was inconsistent, you know, and, like, they didn't know
what it was.
You know,
yeah.
They didn't know exactly what they wanted. You know, and that's a tribute to Joss Whedon there too, because, like, he knew what would make it work, you know?
Yeah.
And when it didn't work in the movie, he took, you know, the elements that were good, kept them, and, you know, managed to slice out all the stuff that wasn't working, and then, you know, put it together into a package that really worked.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I wonder if Bryan Singer, like, saw this thing. You know, because, I mean, you know, you've got Avi Arad, who's listed as one of the producers, and you've got, obviously, Stan Lee, who's, like, a executive producer on everything. But I just wonder if Singer looked at this and picked it apart and was like, I need to look at what I need to avoid, or if he just started, like, on his own template. Or
yeah,
whoever
yeah.
wrote the script for the X-Men.
That's a good question. Bryan Singer, if you're listening, let us
know. We would love to
know. Let us know, because I love the idea of Bryan Singer out there watching this on TV.
Well, not even just watching it on TV, just getting in his research material and going, like, what do I need to avoid? Because the first X-Men movie very clearly avoids the pitfalls of this movie, where, you know, they have a dynamic villain who is very serious, you know what I mean, who's not playing it for laughs. They focus on his story, but not too much. They focus on the just about everyone's backstory, but, like, that's another failure of this thing. It's like, it's so funny you bring up Wolverine. It's like, it's obvious in that first X-Men movie that they made a choice, like, Wolverine is the character that everyone loves. Wolverine is the one that we're going to give more focus to. Wolverine is the one who we're going to develop around, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And they should have made that choice with Generation X. It should have been Jubilee, you know, being the one that they focused on the most, and following her as she's an outsider trying to fit into this group of mutants. Instead, she gets to the school and the focus just splinters, and they don't know what they're doing. So I feel like
the biggest thing that this suffers from is playing the villain for laughs, giving the villain way too much of the screen time, and then not picking at least one character to be the central like vision of the film and be like, all this mutant stuff is crazy, because that's why the first X-Men film succeeds, you know what I mean? And that's is because Wolverine, like the rest of us, are like, what is all this crazy stuff? And Jubilee shows up, and then as soon as she gets to the school and meets the other kids, it's like, oh yeah, we're all friends, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
there's really no conflict or inner turmoil. So yeah, I feel bad, but you know.
Yeah, I feel bad, but you know, again, it was like sort of a, you know, it was an experiment, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm actually pleased that you know, some elements of it did work, you know, because man, you know, things could have gone even horribly wronger.
I don't know. It's tough to.
As I'm sure that we'll find out as we continue this, experiment
this
here.
Well, you know, I have to say, I mean, I am glad I watched it again. It was a bit of a bore, but it reminds you of things like, that's the thing is like, so many, sometimes people will be like, oh, why'd you watch that bad movie or whatever? And I think you can learn as much from watching something bad as something good. You know what I mean? And, you know, I don't know that I would recommend this, quite honestly. I feel like our slogan should be like, we watched this so you don't have to. Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, it's on YouTube, so anyone who's listening, you can find it, you can watch it. The quality is not really good. It's obviously like a VHS copy or whatever, which, you know, why doesn't Marvel like release these online somewhere, like clean it up, put it, because people would watch this. I guarantee you that there's people that would like totally watch it streaming for like $2 or $3.
Dude, according to this, you know, 277,000 people have watched it so far. So.
Yeah, I know.
Actually, you know, the thing that's kind of frustrating for me is that like this has double the views of the Doctor Strange movie.
Really?
Yeah.
And that by far is the more fun, you know.
Although neither of them come anywhere close to the nearly over 2 million views of that horrible Justice League of America.
I have yet to see that. I've never seen it. Do they have the full thing on YouTube, or is it just
I don't
like
know. I think it's broken into parts.
Oh my God, that might be our next one. Holy cow. Maybe we should try and pick something that might be a little better in quality.
Okay, we'll have to work on it. If somebody has any ideas, I'm open for it.
Oh my God! So, any last thoughts or comments on the Generation X TV pilot? That, you know, I mean, honestly, the thing that frustrates me the most is that it could have been really good. Like, you probably could have salvaged this and done something really good with it, but. You know, it just wasn't meant, I guess it just wasn't meant to be, you know?
It wasn't meant to be, you know, it you know, some, for some reason, you know, again, it's cool that somebody did do something with it, you know, at some point, but, you know, I'm really glad now that, you know, effects at least have caught up with, you know, with comic book level stuff, you know, and this definitely, I mean, you know, CG may get a lot of shit thrown at it, but man, after watching this, it's like, I'm actually pretty glad that we have CG.
Well, and that's the thing that I realize, like whenever anyone is like, CG is so fake or whatever. And I'm like, you know what? That is true that a lot of CG looks fake, but look at the alternative. I mean, I like practical effects and stuff, but without the aid of CG, like it could be a lot worse. And we've had a lot. I mean, we've got 20 years at least of bad superhero sci-fi, you know, movies where they were attempting effects and it just doesn't work. At least now it's a little easier to achieve stuff and, you know,
and
the thing is like, for me, it's like, it doesn't need to look realistic as long as I can lose myself in the story a bit and in the plot and in the characters and stuff like that. And that's what I feel like. I feel like, that this was like a really
good template for what the X-Men movies became, but it really, like, I almost feel like if this hadn't been made, maybe that first X-Men movie might have been a disaster. Like, I really feel like this was a template for Bryan Singer or everyone at Marvel to go, let's avoid this, let's look at this and pull it apart. Because this is basically like an X-Men movie. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, and it definitely, you know, follows, you know, a lot of the sort of the, like you were saying, a lot of the order of the X-Men movie.
Yeah.
You've got like the outsider coming in, you know, learning about the school, you know, and then, you know, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, if anything, like I said, if you want to know like what horrors the 90s were capable of, this is a good place to start.
All right. We will leave it at that. So this has been another episode of Part-Time Fanboy, where we have examined the inner workings of the Generation X TV pilot filmed, or at least debuted, in 1996. My name is Christian Horn.
And I'm Paul Edwards.
And hopefully we will be back again next week with another episode of Part-Time Fanboy. Thanks for listening.
Part-time fanboy.